The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Tuesday, August 29th, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Betsy Hartman, author of The American Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Call to Greatness. Also on our the program today, for members, a special Matt's Pick Deep Archive hit. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we're on a much-needed vacation. I imagine now we've been gone for 2 days live. At least we haven't been live for 2 days. And I would imagine by now, I don't know. Matt, you want to try and predict what's happened with Donald Trump?
I'm going to be bold and say
P-tape.
He's resigned.
Really?
I mean, I don't think that's going to happen, but I just want to call it if it does.
All right. Well, you just sort of undercut.
Well, just out of personal annoyance with the situation, not because he understands how much trouble he's in or anything like that. But
I don't think he's going to resign. I think it's possible by now the P tape has come out, and then in response to that, I think that happened probably over the weekend, and then by Sunday, he had attacked North Korea. But in attempting to press the button, Mattis tackled him, right? And prevented him from doing it. But then John Kelly, an unlikely, because they're both generals, started beating up Mattis. Trump reached over and hit the button, sent a weapon to North Korea, and then there's been horrible carnage. I think that's possible.
I think that's going to happen, except the missile is only going to kill the bad North Koreans, and then Trump's going to be a hero.
Or there's also a version where Trump launches it, and because of the way that he hits the button, like, you know, sometimes like you jiggle, you got like your earphone connections a little bit loose, so sometimes you're only getting one side, you hear only one side.
Right.
So he hits the button. He hits it just on the side, and it causes the missile to go straight up in the air and then land just on him.
Yeah.
I mean,
a good safety feature, actually.
Oh, and they also had taken out the nuclear warhead, so it's just literally just...
like a child safety.
Yeah, and it's just, so it just, oh, I hit the wrong button. Oh, I forgot to put that in there. And it landed on Trump. We're not calling for anything, and we're not doing anything that would ever get us in trouble with the Secret Service or anything like that. We're just making wild predictions.
Not that they're funded to respond to anything like that, but
no. But assuming you're still here, folks, we will take a quick break and we'll come back with the America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and A Call to Greatness. And I just want to remind you, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you bonus material. And of course, you have the ability to search our archives too. Not the deep, deep archives that Matt is setting up for you. Those are untouchable. You need to have, really, there's only one member of the show who can access those. And it's a Matt Leck level membership. But there's a lot of downside that comes with that too. You gotta come into the office, and so, you know. All right, folks, enjoy this interview, and we've got interviews for you tomorrow. We've got stuff from members on Thursday, another interview on Friday, and then, of course, our Labor Day show, and then we will be back live next Tuesday. Enjoy. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program retired Hampshire College professor of development studies, Betsy Hartman. She is the author of The America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Calls to Greatness. Betsy, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Now, I say, you know, I was drawn to this book because I have always felt that, to a certain extent, particularly, I don't know, I had friends of my generation, I guess Generation X, and there was always a sense of lurching from one apocalyptic vision to another. And I had always attributed it in some level to having been born in the shadow of the millennium. That, I mean, I remember as a kid just thinking like the year 2000, that's going to be crazy. And we certainly have had, you know, sort of apocalyptic scares around that. But let's start at the beginning where you do that. This country's founding had built into it a notion, a fixation with doomsday.
Right, right. You know, I trace this our infatuation with apocalypse from the Puritans on to the present day. But certainly the way the country was founded, the Puritan mission of creating a new millennium, a new world in New England that would light the way for Christendom across the world, and also a fear of the end of the world coming, and a kind of apocalyptic fear also, both those things intertwined, were very much part of our heritage, and later, you know, it became expressed in less religious terms, but in more kind of secular terms, history as prophecy, we as the chosen people, our mission to save the world, all these things have endured far past the Puritans.
And so, I mean, so how is it that the case that it does? I mean, that's was the Puritans that philosophy so deeply rooted that it can carry through generations? I mean, what has helped, I guess, maintain that sense?
Right. Well, I think partly American exceptionalism, for sure, the idea that we are special and a chosen people. That has been, you know, that endures then till now and enshrined in, you know, our founding fathers' view of the United States. And the kind of the idea that the U.S. has a providential mission. I also argue in the book that fundamental to our apocalyptic vision is the violence and war that accompanied the founding of the country, the Western expansion, you know, the genocide of the Native Americans, the also genocide of Mexican Americans, that violence and war are so intrinsic to the American mission, and especially today in this kind of age of permanent war, and that war itself, our vision of war is you know, Christian or not, even if you're not a Christian, in a large respect drawn from the book of Revelation, in the Bible, and this idea that war is inevitable and is also a cleansing that leads the way to the New Jerusalem, and that war is justified. These also run deep in American culture, so I think we can't separate our apocalyptic disposition from our drive for empire and our continued drive for empire.
Are those two things coincidental, or do they emanate from each other?
Well, I think they work together. I mean, apocalyptic thinking isn't necessarily about war. War isn't necessarily about apocalyptic thinking, or doesn't necessarily derive from it. But they do have an overlap. And I think, you know, the fact that we're founded on, we have such a violent history that we often really don't acknowledge, and you know, the fear of eternal war, that war is always going to be happening, drives a certain apocalyptic disposition in us, I believe. And, you know, right now, for example, we're in a period where we're in a state of permanent war, where, you know, we're at war in the Middle East, And except for those people who have to go into the army often for economic reasons, much of the population remains fairly removed. Yet it's a constant reality, and also the military industrial complex has kind of come home to roost domestically as well, in terms of police violence, militarization of the police, the anti-immigrant raids. So we have a very violent society at home too. And this can't help but influence kind of our nightmares of our visions of the world.
Well, I mean, so is it because we have this, intrinsic sense of that there is a world ending catastrophe around every corner. I mean, I can see it in the context of how we went into Iraq, right? We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. In the context of Vietnam, it's the domino theory, right? Theoretically, it starts over there, and then all of a sudden, we're the last domino, I guess. You can certainly see how it's the need. I mean, how much of it is that it exists in us, and how much of it is that it's been nurtured because of people's political agendas.
Right. It's a long cultural tradition, but certainly, I mean, if you look at the Trump era right now and, Steve Bannon's belief in this kind of fourth turning, that there's going to be a major war that's kind of going to be the next, usher in the next stage of history, Judeo-Christianity against, Islamic terrorism and the Chinese or whatever, you see these understandings or discourses or threats are presented in a way that are very apocalyptic and serve certain political agendas for sure. And, part of the reason I wrote the book is that I grew up in the generation that grew up during the Cold War and the threat of the nuclear bomb and under the shadow of kind of nuclear Holocaust. And certainly then, too, I mean, it was a very real threat, and unfortunately we're still facing the nuclear threat today. But it was a, ever-present threat, and society was organized around kind of responding to this threat. The country, really the military-industrial complex, really, as Eisenhower gets big, push during this era, and the U.S. has to have more nuclear weapons than the Soviet Union, for example. So that was, one of the things I tried to do in the book is show how that period, instilled a lot of fear and horror of the future in many of us, children and adults, but that there was also a strategic dimension to kind of the psychological preparation of the homeland for nuclear war.
I mean, how is this, though? I mean, is this uniquely American? I mean, it seems to me that, this is a tactic that is used by, leaders and political leaders, to maintain their power or to maintain a certain power structure that, just in this day and age, Kim Jong-un creates that sort of apocalyptic fervor that we could get wiped off the map. I mean, I know this is something you see this. Is it uniquely American, or what makes it uniquely American? And certainly, the threat of nuclear war was real, but it was almost the development of those weapons and the use of them were arguably because of an apocalyptic concern relative to the Soviet Union, right? I mean, but how is this uniquely American when it's carried out in this way?
Right. I mean, I think that's a good question, and certainly other countries, have apocalyptic political tendencies also. But there's a peculiarly kind of America, I call it the America syndrome, and it has to do with the way that apocalyptic thinking interacts with other key features of our kind of mindset or national cultural mindset, I should say. And again, not everybody, you know, exhibits these, you know, these what I call the seven deadly synergies. But it is a very, we have a strong cultural propensity towards apocalypse. And from my travels in the world anyway, I find Americans to be the most apocalyptic. And also that it's so intertwined with other aspects of our culture. And some of these, which what I call the seven deadly synergies.
Yeah, would
are,
you outline those for us?
Yeah, American exceptionalism, the idea that we are God's chosen people is one of them, and that we're at the center of the moral universe, you know. Second would be, again, belief in a coming apocalypse, and pessimistically we're headed toward a violent end of the world, but optimistically a golden millennium awaits us. In either case, though, history is an unfolding prophecy and time itself turns on a spiritual clock. And thirdly, and I think this is really important also for this moment, it is susceptibility to sermonizing. I mean, the Puritans perfected this form of political sermon called the Jeremiad, which continues to trap us. Lots of politicians use it, left and right. It castigates us for our sins and calls for repentance so that we may renew ourselves and fulfill the promise of America. And I almost feel like Donald Trump sometimes is a Twitter sermonizer, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Fourthly, expansion, occupation, and empire, what I was talking about before, the idea that this land is our land, and to reach our God-given destiny, war is just and extreme violence justified. And we tend to paint ourselves as victims and the victims as perpetrators. Fifth would be exclusion, inequality, and duality. In order for the chosen people, a.k.a. white Protestants mainly, to be who they are, they must distinguish themselves from those who they're not. And those who don't conform don't belong or should be punished or banished. And hierarchies are sanctified by the invisible hand of God. And the world is sharply divided between good and evil, friend and foe. And I think this is really important here, the kind of dualisms that the media feeds us to, politicians feed us. Americans are not masters of nuance. Six, nature is fractured mirror. And I'm sure this happens in other places, but it's a particularly American way that we project onto nature, I think, the tensions and contradictions of our providential mission. Nature is both a wilderness to be tamed and a continent to be conquered. It's also an apocalypse over the horizon. And at the same time, it's a sublime landscape where we can escape the wounds of civilization. So we have all these kind of fractured views of nature that can come together in rather odd ways. And lastly, paranoia and anxiety. Americans tend to see enemies everywhere, and they even lurk inside us in dark and distressing emotions. Part of this comes from American exceptionalism and this idea that we have to be the leaders of the world, that we're the chosen people, that we have to be pure enough and worthy of our special place in the divine design. I think the Puritans helped introduce this specific anxiety into the culture, especially since the Puritans believed that they, you know, were predestined toward heaven or hell, and they wouldn't find out until their deathbeds, even if they lived the most, you know, righteous life. Also, in the marketplace where money is worshipped as a marker of status, we're beset with anxiety that we don't have enough of it or never will. So I gave a talk recently at a local library, and a woman said she thought this apocalyptic disposition existed because people were so, it was so impossible to live up to these ideals. People needed a way out, and especially for poor people to live up to these ideals because they would never, you know, be rich enough to merit a special place in the universe. The idea that the world's going to come to an end and in certain ways an escape from this need to be pure and successful and to be the kind of perfect American.
You know, I have to say, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves in terms of climate change and how that's been framed and your critique of that. But when you go through those seven synergies, and maybe it's my own predisposition, but I hear a lot of attributes of what the of the conservative movement in that, right? I mean, I have often described them as having a Masada complex, this notion that there are, there's great political treaties written on the paranoid mind, I think, of Americans in political thought, and the idea, obviously, of exceptionalism. I mean, this is one of the greatest critiques of President Obama, is that he didn't seem to appreciate American exceptionalism and or didn't delineate between evil and good. The idea of you know, we are subject to so many possible enemies, internal and external, you know, ranging from, Sharia law to forced homosexuality, on and on. I mean, these seem to make up, at least, you know, largely speaking, these are conservative attributes. Am I projecting?
Well, I think they largely are. In a certain way, we're seeing, you know, under Trump, the kind of apotheosis or something of this American syndrome and its conservative manifestations. But it's not just conservatives who fall trapped to these things. And I talk a bit in the book about how the left, for example, can be very millennial and believe like the new world is right around the corner if only we could just, you know, get rid of capitalism tomorrow, for example. Or that if we can't do that, the world's going to, you know, go to hell in a handbasket immediately. And also this desire for kind of political purity. Of course, you can't trace it all to apocalypticism, but it's dominant on both left and the right. And I think we need to fight the idea that we can achieve, you know, this purity it's very much part of the perfectionism, and purity is part of kind of the new Jerusalem, the new millennium. That is in left-wing thought as well as in right-wing thought.
That notion that we, like a utopian vision.
Yes. I mean, in the book I talk about, you know, the fine line between utopian vision, because, I mean, utopian vision is also important. We need to think about what kind of future we want or what kind of society we want. But when it strays into a kind of millennial madness that, you know, people are perfectible, that we can achieve this kind of perfect society, it obscures the, you know, eternal messiness of politics, the messiness of history, And it can be sort of ahistorical that we could kind of jump into this perfect world. And I think I'm not branding all leftists with this by any means, and I'm on the progressive side of the spectrum. But I've seen it in myself growing up too. As a young adult, I was very much into this kind of millennial madness. So I write the book, you know, partly out of my own personal experience the kind of 60s movements.
But do you think that's embedded in, well, I guess it is to a certain extent, a certain utopianism. It has at least broad strains within leftist thought. It doesn't seem to be as central to me as the sense of paranoia, the sense of sort of a Manichean worldview. And the idea of, you know, morally sermonizing and American exceptionalism seem to be a little more central to a conservative perspective. But tell us before we get to how you think that impacts these synergies. I mean, and when you talk about these synergies, perhaps maybe it's worth also just, maybe it's embedded in what you call them, but how do they play on each other? Is there a specific dynamic that feeds each other's, or do they just sort of they go into a jumble and all of these impulses reinforce each other?
Right. Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, it depends on the context. But one of my chapters, and it's been my life's work, really, I work on international population reproductive rights issues. And I examine how the American view of the wilderness and nature impacts our view of demographic dynamics and has led or helped lead to this idea that the world is overpopulated, that it's overpopulation of poor people that's destroying the environment, and the kind of idea of a pristine wilderness. And, you know, there have been lots of other people who have criticized this kind of wilderness ethic. And, again, I'm not arguing here against preserving wilderness. Please don't get me wrong. But there's, you know, some of these ways that we view nature also impact our view of international development, of population policy, of poor people in other countries. And, you know, there's, again, a kind of, and this is, often happens in kind of, in, you know, mainstream environmental circles, the idea is that we're kind of the stewards of the environment and those people over there are bad and are degrading the environment and are overpopulating. So there's another example where you get a dualism too. Within kind of the population debate historically, it's kind of been presented as a two-sided affair with, for example, like Paul Ehrlich on one side of the population bomb, a conservation biologist, you know, arguing, you know, that the world's, again, going to go to hell, overpopulation causes famine, war, et cetera. And then on the other hand, you had kind of free marketeers like Julian Simon, who argue that, you know, population is the ultimate resource, that too much government regulation is bad for the environment, and the free market will do the trick. So, the you know, the media kind of presented those as the two sides. And one thing I argue in my book is we need to get beyond these kind of dualism. And, for example, women's health advocates and environmental justice advocates have been arguing a long time for a much more nuanced approach, looking at, you know, the political economy of the environment, who's destroying the environment, what forces are, what is the role of population pressure, and, again, contextualizing it instead of these kind of simplistic ideologies. So I try in the book to find examples to pull out how these synergies work together in specific instances or on big issues. And again, there's not one way they work together, but it's kind of fascinating to see in each case how they are linked together and enforce each other.
And you argue that the that this is also that the our tendency to frame things up from an apocalyptic perspective inhibit the efficacy of fighting against climate change. And I have to say that bring that out for me. I mean, because you know, I can't help but think of there's this British scientist, I believe he's still alive, a guy named James Lovelock, who found the hole in the ozone layer, and it was, you know, 40-50 years ago, I guess now, 30-40 years ago, and they had asked him in the early aughts about climate change, and he said, you know, this recycling, everything that everybody's doing is really nice, but that conversation's about 20 or 30 years too old. By the end of the century, Europe will be sub-Saharan. You know, shortly thereafter that, 80% of the world's population will be dead. And they said, that's a very pessimistic outlook. And he said, no, I'm a scientist. I don't think there's necessarily something any better about 6 billion people than 1 billion. and I wonder, I mean, is the idea that, I mean, in what you see as problematic, do you see it as an exaggeration of, or is it that it is the framing of it makes an apocalyptic vision for climate change makes it hard to deal with?
Well, I would say both. You know, interesting, Lovelock has dialed back on his apocalypticism around climate change, interestingly. But, you know, climate change is extremely urgent it's already having, you know, deep impacts. We're seeing them, and I don't in any way, shape, or form want to be cast as a climate denialist, right? And partly because we have climate deniers in this country, people, I think, are pushed into being more apocalyptic. Because, I mean, climate change demands an urgent response, but many practical responses, for example, we need to move swiftly out of fossil fuels into renewable energies, you know? We need to have more public transport. We need to rethink a kind of our whole energy system. So those are very important and political and economic challenges, but they're not insurmountable. And in fact, you know, I think as more and more countries, and even in the United States, as more and more states, even if the federal government is remiss, are starting to take action on climate change and affecting an energy, transition, people are becoming a little less apocalyptic. That doesn't mean that bad things aren't going to happen because we've already, you know, raised temperatures, sea levels are rising, glaciers are melting. These are all extremely serious, challenges. So my take on it is, but it's not the end of the world, you know. We're not heading toward the apocalypse. We're not heading toward 6 billion people dying. That human beings can be adaptable, they can be resilient in the face of disaster, and we also need to work on how best actually to protect the people most vulnerable to climate change, you know, for example, poor populations in cities by the sea, where affected by sea level rise, what kind of infrastructure, technological development, what kind of economic policies will best protect people. So we need to move beyond the idea that the world's going to come to an end and say, hey, this really is serious, and we need to be, you know, active right now in all these dimensions. And then secondly, I argue in the chapter that apocalyptic thinking on climate change can inspire fatalism when actually we need more proactive, policies. So it can be dangerous in that respect, and it can also reinforce, especially in notions of climate conflict and climate refugees, which I go through in the book, it can reinforce very racialized images of poor people in the global south, particularly in Africa, as being more prone to violence, kind of this whole idea if there's bad weather, they'll start fighting each other. And that's why, you know, the U.S. military needs to intervene more in Africa, for example. I mean, I trace how the military is using some of these kind of climate conflict and climate refugee, arguments and narratives, and they're very problematically based on negative views of poor people, especially people of color, using it to justify further intervention and militarization.
Because I know you also cite the example of the Syrian conflict, which has been there have been arguments made that because of drought and the impact that it had on, particularly on wheat production in Syria, that Syria had to spend down a lot of its strategic supplies of wheat or sell it off as a way of raising money, and that this created further fissures in the country, and that led to a civil war, which led to refugees. I mean, is there something in that chain of events that you take issue with, or is it that you think that there's something problematic in the way that that perspective is applied to the refugees? I mean, it seems to me that there is a certain reality to maybe Lovelock is wrong and 5 billion people won't die. I know he's dialed it back. I've also spoken to environmentalists who say it's a conscious effort on my part not to be apocalyptic about it, even though secretly I do feel that way because I don't want people to be fatalistic. I mean, we don't really know how bad it can get. We do know that there is, you know, our implications to extended droughts, to extreme weather, to massive flooding that will implicate particularly people who are living in undeveloped underdeveloped countries with less of an infrastructure. People who are living in low-level areas relative to sea rise. People who are poor. I mean, these. This is a fairly consistent with or without climate change. That when there's a natural disaster or even when there's a man-made one, the first people to generally take the brunt of it are people who are living closer to poverty.
Right, precisely. But it doesn't mean, for example, it doesn't mean they're going to cause wars. So, I mean, we need to also separate this kind of war and violence discourse that's being associated with climate change. We need to separate that out. And obviously, we need to, disaster response is really important. Adaptation measures are really important, especially in the most vulnerable communities. And it's also important to note that most serious climate migration research argues that people are more likely to move within national borders than across them. So the kind of alarmist discourses we're seeing about climate refugees, it doesn't mean people, some people won't migrate across borders, but really, refugee migration right now is political and due to war.
Right.
And I really find the Syrian case, there are studies coming out now suggesting it's quite incorrect the way the linkage has been presented, that climate change is somehow responsible for the Syrian war, that the drought itself, there are periodic droughts in Syria, it's not clear it was caused by climate change. Second, that the level of migration was not as great as claimed. Thirdly, that those people that did migrate actually weren't very active in the protest against the Assad regime and weren't a key linchpin. And that it was more Syrian policies, both toward the environment, also kind of the removal of agricultural subsidies for poor farmers and, disastrous decades of, water or the non-existence of water policy. Or water policies that allowed the kind of draining of aquifers that are much more responsible for the environmental crisis there. So, and I think you have to look at the geopolitics. So we don't want to depoliticize what's going on, for example, in Syria by what I argue is kind of a naturalization of the conflict is somehow due to climate change. Same thing in 2007 was said about Darfur, in Sudan. And now, the academic research comes through and people say, no, climate change was not implicated very much, if at all, in the Darfur conflict. But so these narratives come up periodically and people jump on them, partly because they believe it and it's presented to them in a compelling way. And secondly, though, because of our apocalyptic disposition or the belief that people, in the face of disaster, people will necessarily fight rather than cooperate. And, you can find many instances where people actually cooperate in times of disaster. It doesn't mean it always happens, but how do we implement the kind of conditions under which people cooperate and come together to deal with the urgent problems associated with climate change?
I imagine, too, I mean, part of the impetus, I don't know if it's a correct reaction, but is also to say, your hair's on fire. You got to go stick your head in some water. Maybe it's just getting warmer. I mean, in other words, it's the only way to get the type of response that is necessary. I guess that's something that we'll have a better sense of in 50 or 60 years, or I guess the next generation will. The people who work in this office, not myself.
Well, I would say climate change is bad enough now, right? That the effects of climate change are bad enough now that we better get on it right away, right? So, I mean, we don't need to create apocalyptic narratives. I mean, the glaciers are melting, the sea level is rising, So,
it's not necessarily been able to convince a significant amount of the population. I mean, part of the tradition that spurs that apocalyptic vision also suggests that God will take care of it.
Right. No, and that is why we live in a kind of crazy country in terms of this kind of marriage between climate denialism and also kind of right-wing, you know, apocalyptic vision of the, you know, environmental crisis, right? And, you know, and believing it's God-given, or, the Earth is only, what, 6,000 years old or whatever. You know, so you have this kind of anti-scientific, you have the anti-scientific kind of right-wing Christian ideology wed to especially, you know, years of fossil fuel industry funding climate denialism, you know, and bogus science. So we're faced with that. I mean, it's understandable why people appeal, you know, climate change, people who work on climate change appeal to the apocalyptic, but I don't think it's very useful.
So, okay, so finally, what is, I mean, what's the answer here? This is ultimately, it's a call to, for a little bit more sobriety so that we can assess these things. Is there also a, perhaps a recipe or a suggestion as to how we can sort of diffuse the use of the of this, or diminish, I guess, the influence of this sort of birthright that we have?
Yeah, well, good question. I mean, I think for me anyway, just starting to think about the impact of apocalyptic thinking on my own life and on my own worldview, and reading more history, has really helped me be less apocalyptic. So in a way, and, you know, in the wake of 9/11 too, you know, feeling apocalyptic at the beginning, but then kind of starting to understand the kind of geopolitics behind why 9/11 happened, for example, helps you then be more lucid about the U.S. role in the Middle East, for example.
Right.
So that lucidity is really important. The other thing that I argue in the book is that kind of collective action is so important. For example, during the Cold War, and especially when Reagan reignited the Cold War in Europe, and people came together from all over the world, you know, in this country, in Europe, all over, at kind of huge marches and actions against nuclear war. And that had a big impact, actually. It helped end the Cold War. And I think the more you're engaged in concrete collective action like that, or involved in environmental climate change work or social justice work, and you're working with other people to affect change, and you occasionally have some victories, of course you have defeats also, but the more you do that, I think the less apocalyptic you tend to be, because you're actually in the real world trying to change it.
Betsy Hartman, the book is The America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Calls to Greatness. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.